Okay, we're beginning on the bottom of Samach Gimel Amud Bet, five lines up. Tanru Banan, Ebe Baraita, Luchim Beitzim Minoevde Kochavim. You're allowed to purchase eggs from non-Jews. B'chol Makom, anywhere. Vein Choshishim, Lo Mishum Nevelot, V'lo Mishum Trefot. You don't worry about the fact that the egg comes from a Nevela, whether the egg comes from a Trefa. Gemara asks a very simple question. V'dima Dov Tameinenu. How do you know it's really from a kosher bird? Maybe it's coming from a non-kosher bird. Why are you so certain that that isn't a problem? Samar Avua de Shmuel. Now we have a Mesorah from Shmuel's father. Be'omer shel of ploni tahor. Where the person selling them says it comes from this particular kosher bird. So he tells you, first of all, it's coming from a kosher bird. But he also tells you this the particular species where it's coming from. Be'lema shel of tahor. Why aren't we just satisfied with the generic statement that it's coming from a kosher bird? Why does he have to specify the bird? Just let him say it's coming from a kosher bird. Because there he can slip out of it. If he mentions just that it came from a kosher bird, and then you come back and say, I don't know any kosher birds that have eggs that look like this, they say, well, it's a bird that you don't know about, or it's another bird, or I meant this bird. So he can wiggle his way out of it. If he states the specific bird from which it came from, then you can do what we call a compare and contrast. And in those types of situations where you can check the information, people are believed. People won't lie when the veracity of their statement can be validated. And that's what Rashi says. Davar shanu yochulim lahavchin ulahavi beitzei otov. Something that we can discern and bring other samples from that bird. They wrote, im domim leilu lo mishaker. You can see that they're similar. Nobody lies about that type of information. Because that's easy to be caught in the lie, and it's not worth it to them. He's going to lose all his business. It's just not a good lie, and therefore we believe him in this situation. Now, the Tosafot asks a very basic question as well. Dilma dof tameinenu, bim tomar, kevin d'ofot torim havi ruba, nezel barte ruba. Didn't we say before, at the end of yesterday's daf, that when it came to the choice between kosher and non-kosher birds, that the number of kosher birds far exceeded that of the non-kosher birds, and that's why the Torah mentions the non-kosher birds rather than the kosher birds. If that's the case, why can't we just go after our rov? Just follow the majority and say that we don't need any information. The egg that he's selling in all likelihood is a kosher egg because the rov of bird eggs are kshirim. The Tosafot says, Ulufi mashi pirashti. What I explained earlier, this was a machloket Rashi and Tosafot, that includes many species, that is okay. Tosafot early on says that the 24 birds that are mentioned, as well as the characteristics that come with them, are a way for us to identify other birds that are tmeim. And there aren't just 24 birds that are tmeim. They are 24 birds that give us an indication about what's wrong with birds that are tmeim. And any bird that's similar in nature would also be tmeim. But Tosafot, it's not as big a deal because you're right. In terms of headline birds that are tmeim, then you can go with 24. That's enough information. That's why the Torah enumerated them rather than the kosher birds. On the other hand, those 24 birds are not just 24 species of birds. They're 24 avot of the birds that are tmeim. But if you get down to it, there are many more avot tmeim. That's the way Tosafot answers. But he says, "Va'af the perish akundris." Even according to Rashi, Delomar Binin Omin Nesher, according to Rashi who says that Nesher is the only thing that includes, meaning that subsets of Nesher are included, but none of the other birds help you out with that situation. Yesh Lomar, Mikom Akom, Hadar Minin El, Meo Fot Meim, Shein, B'Mizrach, Kulan Minayahin, Hilkach Efshar De Yesh B'Tmeim, Minim Harbeit. So then it's possible that by the Tmeim, you have lots of different species. And that even if it's under just the subset of Nesher, you could still have a large number of Minim, and therefore you could reach an excess. Or in essence, maybe what Tosafot is saying is, there's two pieces to what he's saying. Number one is, it might be that there are more species that are Tmeim, just because I say these are headline birds, they're not all the birds. Or, even if you believe maybe there aren't more Minim, it could be that the number of birds exceeds the number of kosher birds. So even though there may be more kosher minim, but population-wise, there may just be more tmeim. So it could be that the majority of eggs out there are going to be non-kosher eggs, even though the majority of species are kosher species. So that's also a possibility that it has to do with population numbers versus actual species. That's a way to deal with it. The Ramban and the Rashba suggest that if you take the kosher birds versus non-kosher birds, kosher birds would be the majority. If you take then from the kosher birds, those that are nevelot, those that are trefot, and then you add them to the side of the non-kosher birds, then you have at least 50-50, maybe a majority, and that's how you have a majority of non-kosher birds over here. Because even within the kosher birds, there's a subset of kosher birds that are problematic. And those are nevelot and trefot. So that's the way that the Baalei Tosafot, the Ramban and the Rashba deal with this. On the other hand, you could just suggest that when you deal with a robe, there are different types of robe. There's super robes, and then there's basic robes. So when we say that the majority of the minim are kosher birds, doesn't mean necessarily that it's an overwhelming majority. That's 95% kosher birds, 5% non-kosher birds. Could be that you're dealing with a 60-40 or a 55-45 type of majority. And in that case, would you really want to rely on that when you're buying eggs? It's too close a call. So that could be also another way to explain it, is that what type of majority are you dealing with over here? But for that reason, we don't rely on the rove, but rather we rely on the rove plus the fact that he's declaring to us. He's telling us that the eggs that they're selling are from a kosher bird. And I heard Rabbi Slivkin mention, just on a commercial level, there are no eggs that are worth raising commercially, and that can produce that number of eggs that one can sell, except for kosher birds, or really chickens, which are the main producer of eggs. And therefore, there's a high likelihood that if someone is selling them commercially, then in all likelihood, they're kosher eggs, because that's the only viable commercial egg that there really is. Other eggs can be one-offs, but they're not going to be sold on commercial quantities. And therefore, that's also something that helps us out in this situation. Mara says, "V'lid dok b'simanim." Why don't you just check the simanei of the beitzim, which means the character traits of the beitzim, and through that, you'll get your information. Titania, "K'simanei beitzim, kach simanei dagim." Says a flashback to Avodah Zarah, that we had there that the simanim of the eggs are similar to the simanim of fish. Mara says, "Simanei dagim?" Talking about the simanei kashrut of dagim. Sakadatcha, how could you say that? Snapir v'kaskeset, Amar Rachmana. Those are explicit in the Torah. Fins and scales. With an egg, you're not speaking about fins and scales. That makes no sense to compare them. Ela eima kach simanei ubrei dagim. Rather, don't say that it's speaking about the fish themselves, but rather it's speaking about the offspring of the dagim. V'tanya gabi beitzim. And we have a bright by beitzim, although some eliminate the word v'tanya over here because it's a continuation of the previous braita. Elu hein simanei beitzim. These are the indicators of what kosher beitzim look like. Koshik koderet ve'agul golet rosha echad kad rosha echad chad tehora. That's the case, then it's a kosher egg. So Rashi over here explains that there are four features that are mentioned here. He says that koderet and a gulgolet really are symbiotic in describing the egg over here. Because had you had the word just a gulgolet, had you just had circular, then you could envision a circle, as Rashi says, like kanadasha, like a lentil that's circular, or cheese that is circular, which one of two things could either mean that it is just two-dimensional, which is it's a flat circle, or a gulgola could be like a cone-shaped item, which would also be like a cheese that is round. It's more like a cone-shaped type of circular to it. So a gulgola by itself would not be enough. That's why you need the word kuderet, which Rashi here views as being like a kadur, like a ball. And just like a ball is narrower at the ends, but then thickens towards the middle, meaning that the largest circumference of the ball is in the center, and then as you move towards the top and the bottom, it narrows itself down. So that's what the addition of koderet is. So between the two of them, you get there koderet and a gulgolet, which would mean that a gulgolet tells you it's circular. Koderet tells you that it's a circle that tapers, or in essence, that it is a ball. So that's Rashi's view of it. And then Tosafot over here quotes Rashi from other places, as well as a girsa of the Rabbeinu Tam, that the word over here is not koderet, but rather kodetet. That means coming from a kad. That means like a barrel, and not like a ball. And then the meaning of it over here would be that a gogolet means circular, two-dimensional. And then kadedet would mean that like a kad, that it's cone-like in shape, which is that it's three-dimensional. The circle is not a flat circle, but rather a circle that rises, it's cone-shaped. And then you have the other two features, gives us additional information, which is rosho echad kad. One side is circular, like a barrel. Rosho echad chad. And one side is pointed, then it is tohora. Or in essence, you have what you know as eggs that you see today, which is that they are oval shaped. They're not really circular like a ball. And they're also not whole like an oblong shaped would have been, which is that if they were narrow and pointed at both ends, or if they were circular at both ends, one would be like a ball, the other one would look like an American football. So that would be tapered at both ends and long, narrow. Or if you're doing like a soccer ball, that would be completely round. Over here, you have one end that looks like the American football and the other end that looks like a soccer ball. And so there it's oval-shaped in nature. And that's a sign that the egg is a kosher egg. So then, bet roshei kadin, on the other hand, if both sides are rounded, again, like a soccer ball, or bet roshei kadin, or both sides are pointed, like an American football, tmeim. Those eggs are problematic. They clearly come from the tmeim. So then, chelbon mibachutz. If you have the white of the egg, the albumin of the egg, outside, vechelmon. And again, the way to remember this is, chelbon has the word lavan embedded in it, and the word chelmon has the word limon embedded in it. Vechelmon is the yellow, the yolk of the egg, mibifnim, tohora. If it's structured where the yolk is in the center, and then the albumin, the white, is on the outside, that is a kosher egg. Chelmon mibachutz, vechelbon mibifnim. If you have the yellow on the outside, and the chelbon mibifnim, and the white on the inside, tmeya, it's problematic. Whether such an egg exists is very questionable. In Sichat Chulin, he mentions that he doesn't know any evidence of an egg like this. It could be that instead of being like the chicken egg, where the yolk is in the middle and the white is on the outside, it could be that they just separate side to side, or something like that, where it's some sort of identifying factor that's different than a yolk sitting in the middle and having a white around it. Chelmon v'chelbon me'uravim zebzeh. If they are mixed together, the yellow and the white, biyadua shid beitzat hasheretz, then you know it's coming from a reptilian egg rather than a bird egg, because there are certain shvatzim that also lay eggs, not just birds lay eggs in terms of reproduction, and then it would be a beitzat hasheretz. Again, what that exactly means, that the yellow and white are mixed together, that would already be muzeret. And then how would you know that it was yellow and white? They're all mixed together. It has to be either that they are in an odd shape, or that there's no separation between them, or one of them is exceedingly bigger than the other. It has to be something that's odd about it, rather than what you normally would see in a kosher egg. So now Gemara says that, why don't you just check the eggs out? Why do you need, first of all, the rove that we said before to say that majority of eggs are kosher? Number two, you need the dealer to tell you which bird the egg came from. Why do you need to tell you any information? Take one look at the egg and you'll know it's a kosher egg. What's the shape of the egg that he's showing you? And then you'd have all the information you'd want to know or that you need to know. And therefore, why are we even bothered with asking him any information or getting any information from him? Just do the shape test and you'll know. My answer is that in this case, we have a problem, which is because they are tzricha dechatuchot, that they're already cut, in that the egg's already opened, and there's no way to identify the shape of the egg because the shell is gone. Now, we're dealing with an egg, not with an egg in a shell. Believe dog, v'chelmon v'chelbon. Why don't you look at the yolk and the albumin? You'll see the breakdown of where the yellow and the white are, and you'll know that it's a kosher egg as well. Bitrufot bikara. They are already scrambled or mixed in a dish or in a pan where they've already lost any identity. You've lost both the shape because the shell is no longer there, and you've lost the yellow and white indicators because they are mixed together in a manner that you can no longer discern where the chelmon and chelbon were, where the yolk and the albumin were. Ukiyai gabna mizabnina minayu. In that situation, do we really purchase from them? Are you allowed to purchase from a non-Jew? Basically, what is a scrambled egg in essence? Vahatanyo, emochrim beitzat treifa lo'oved kochavim. You're not allowed to sell a non-kosher egg, This is from a kosher bird, but the bird was a treifa, and therefore the egg has a status of being a treifa. That treifa egg, you're only allowed to sell to a non-Jew if you already scrambled the egg. You've already ruined the egg in a way that it's no longer identifiable. There's no shell, and there's no egg inside that you can discern the chelmon and the chelbon. It's mixed up, and you can sell it in a kara to them. Lefikach. Therefore, in lochimeh beitzim trufot bikara. It's basically siman, which is that if we only allow you to sell these non-kosher eggs from kosher birds to a non-Jew in this manner, then we're going to tell you don't buy in this manner from the non-Jew. It's a self-created problem that we have, but it's an issue because you want to get rid of eggs that are not kosherim, and those eggs you have to sell to someone. Our fear is, based on what we're saying here, that if you're allowed to buy the eggs from non-Jews, then how are we going to be able to identify when the egg sold to the non-Jew was a kosher egg versus a non-kosher egg? He'll say, I bought him from so-and-so the Israel. Or he'll say, it came from a kosher bird. And the truth is, it did come from a kosher bird. It happens to be that bird was a treifa and not a kosher bird that was really kosher in this situation. So now I have an egg with a problem. So that egg with a problem, how do I identify it? I will only sell it to a non-Jew when it's mixed up out of the shell in a kara. And in that way, anybody who's buying from a non-Jew knows not to buy from the non-Jew in that form or fashion because it might have been sold to him by Yisrael that had a problematic egg. And again, you'd have unable to identify it as a kosher egg. You're missing the shells. You're missing the yolk and the albumin. But you also have the information that it came from a kosher bird because it did come from a kosher bird, just a bird that's a treifa. And therefore, you would never be able to discern Elim King, we have this siman that we only sell it to them that way and buy it from them in that way. Ela Amar Rabbi Zeira, simanim lav d'oraita. These indicators here by the eggs are a good indicator, but they're not foolproof. Since they're not foolproof, they're not d'oraita, we can't rely on them. As Rashi says over here, lav halacha l'moshe misinayu. They are not a mesorah from Moshe misinai, v'lo samchinu alayu, and we don't rely on them. They're a good sniff, lahakel. They're good to use in certain situations to help you out, but you can't rely solely on these simanim. Dilo teim halchi, if you don't say that, hamar damar ravasi, before we said in Tav Samach Bet, Hamud Bet, shmona sveikote, there are 8 birds by which we do not know whether they are kshirim or not kshirim. Discussed over there, the difference between Rashi and the Ramosha Bar Yosef as to what the safek was with these birds. But then there would be an easy check. Livdok bebeitzim didhu. Just wait till they lay an egg. Check out the egg. And you'll see the shape of the egg will tell you it's a kosher bird and a non-kosher bird. And then retroactively, you'd know that the bird itself, whether it was a kosher bird or a non-kosher bird. So if simanim were a doraita and they were a foolproof type of check, then it'd be easy to check any bird to know whether it was kosher or not. You'd just wait for an egg and you'd know the information. Alishmamina simanim lav doraita. So it's clear here that the simanim are not min haTorah. Ela lamai hilchata tonilo. So then why tell us the simanim? If they're not foolproof, if they're not useful, why are you telling us about the simanim? Hachi kamar. This is the information that's being conveyed. Beit rosheh kadin, or beit rosheh kadin. If you get an egg that has a circular shape to it, which means that both sides are like a kad, or like a soccer ball, or a beit rosheh kadin, if you get an egg that is pointed at both ends, again, like the American football shape, then, oh, chelmon bi bachutz, vechelbon mi bifnim, or you have the yolk on the outside and the chelbon in the middle, vadai tmeah. That is definitely a non-kosher egg. So it has negative value, which is that it is successful at identifying any egg that comes from a non-kosher bird. If you have these shapes, it's definitely coming from a non-kosher bird. You're not going to find any egg like that that is a kosher egg. That's one piece of information that's very helpful. Reshe chad chad. If one end is pointed, reshe chad chad, and one end is rounded, like a chicken egg, like we know. V'chalbon mi b'chutz v'chalbon b'vnim. And it has the albumin on the outside and the yolk in the inside. V'amar lacha shel of ploni v'tahoru. And then he tells you it came from this kosher bird and it is okay. Smoke alehim. Then you can rely on them. So again, here it's a sniff, which is that you have identifying factors that back up the statement that's being made by the non-Jew. Again, you have a number of factors here. You have the fact that we said majority of eggs come from kosher birds anyway, even though we won't rely on that majority in general, but there is a majority, at least of minim, that are kshirim. Number two is he's identifying for you which bird it came from, and sometimes then you can check. You can match up the eggs from that bird and see if it matches. Number three is the egg is showing signs of what you would have expected from a kosher egg. The combination of all those factors make us believe this seller, the merchant who's selling you the egg here, and say that it is a kosher egg that you're getting because of all these additive factors. But bistama lo tismach aleihem. But in general, don't rely on this as a siman. It's not a foolproof siman. It's not a siman that if you say it, it's definitively a kosher bird. It's just that together with all the other information I have, if I add this in, it just pushes me in the direction of saying it's a kosher bird. The problem is, the urva, the dami to the yona. The problem is that we have the raven's egg, which is similar to the pigeon's egg. It's shaped in that way, which means it has a shape that is very similar to a kosher egg. And given that, you have a issue, which is the eggs can be confused. There are non-kosher eggs that do show signs that are similar to a kosher egg. So in and of itself, those signs aren't sufficient to tell you the egg is kosher. Together with other information, then you could figure out that the egg is kosher. The Rashba points out that even though it could be that he's telling us that it's a bird of a yonah, nevertheless, it could be an orev, but still there is a difference or a distinction between those eggs, and therefore it's still good enough to know that he's telling us that it came from a yonah. But on the other hand, if that's the truth, then why are we worried about this at all? So the answer to that, both the Ramban and the Rashba suggest, has to do with the fact that this is just an example of a problem which identifies that this isn't a foolproof type of siman, and therefore you could have additional birds that simulate the features of a kosher bird, and therefore we can no longer rely on that as being a foolproof siman. The fact that the goy's statement can be verified, he won't lie, that gives him nemanut in this situation. That nemanut bolstered by the fact that you have the simanei beitzim, and you also have the likelihood that the real beitzim are teorim, all of that together pushes us in a direction to say that the eggs are sheirim. But the real threshold that is crossed is that he has no incentive to lie, or won't lie, because he's going to be found out. And people don't lie in situations where it's easy to verify the information and check whether they're lying or not. A couple things to address over here, one of which is something that we moved through quickly, which is that the ubrei dagim, that the ubrei dagim are similar to that of the kosher eggs, in that the shape of the egg would be determinant as to whether it's a kosher or non-kosher egg. The problem with that is that all fish eggs are basically circular. They're round like a soccer ball, and they don't really come in these different shapes that are being described over here. So just to say that the fish egg is similar to a bird egg, and these different shapes would be indicative, or the idea of chelmon and chelbon, also necessarily as relevant by the fish egg. So you have to either say that it's a description of not the egg itself, but the whole package of eggs. When fish lay eggs, they don't lay single eggs. They lay a whole row of eggs, which is then shaped in a certain fashion. And that is what's being said over here. The shape of those totality of eggs is in a shape that is similar to that which would be found in a kosher egg, meaning that it's rounder on one side and narrower on the other side. That's one possibility. Or the other possibility is that we're speaking about some sort of internal organ inside of the fish, which is what otherwise would be the air bladder, are shaped in a similar fashion to the kosher eggs, and that's indicative of the fact that this is a kosher fish. So whether it means kirvei dagim, right, the innards of the dog, or it means ubrei dagim, but it has to mean something more than just the individual egg, because the individual eggs themselves aren't necessarily sufficiently differentiated in shape to say that that is determinant, again, by the game. That's one thing. The second thing is, the Bali Tosafot over here, I have a statement from the Rabbeinu Tam, and then it parlays into amazing Bali Tosafot. It's something that we saw in the Gemara and Avodah Zarah as well. It's worth going over it again, only because it's so foreign to us, and so unbelievable how they interacted in their areas with the non-Jews, that it's worth seeing the Bali Tosafot. I'm going to point out the highlights in the Bali Tosafot. The first of which is that Omer Rabbeinu Tam, the Davka Simanei Beitzim, Mishum Diko Orev, the Damu Yonah. It's really only because by the kosher birds, it's not a definitive sign that you have eggs that are shaped like this, because the raven eggs look like the pigeon eggs, or there is a false positive. which is that you have one egg that tells you it's kosher, and it turns out that it's not kosher. Aval simanei ubrei dagim deoraita yesh lismoch aleihem. So he says that's only a problem by bird eggs. By bird eggs, we have an issue, which is we have one bird that has this problem. So now, from the Rabbeinu Tam, it's clear that he thinks it's a limited scope problem, which is that one bird has an egg that's similar to another bird, and because it could be that raven egg, then it's problematic. There are others, like the Ramban, who expand the view over here, because otherwise, if you know what a raven egg looks like, then you can get rid of this problem, or you then know that any other egg would be kosher egg. So they say, just like the raven egg is similar to the egg of a pigeon, so too there must be other eggs out there that have similarity between them. So this is just a paradigmatic statement that this isn't foolproof, because we know right in front of us we have these eggs that are similar. That means that there might be other eggs out there, and therefore we can't rely on this siman as being foolproof. But either way, what the Rabbeinu Tam is saying is that's uniquely associated with birds. But with the fish, this is a foolproof sign. And then he goes on to say something even more radical, which is just like over here, the Gemara says, had we had a safek by the birds, we could have solved the safek by looking at the eggs of the birds, because had it been foolproof, you just look at the eggs and you'd know whether it was a kosher bird or not a kosher bird. Or, in essence, we still have some information. If it looks a certain way, we know for sure it's a non-kosher bird, but it's not a foolproof to test that it is a kosher bird. But now, looking at fish, you can do the same thing. If simanim by the fish are foolproof, or they are successful at identifying a kosher fish, that means that once we look at the kirvei dagim or the ubrei dagim, then we would know whether it's a kosher fish or not. And if you have a safek about a fish, just look at the eggs of the fish and you'd know. And that's what Tosfot says. V'zeh anu sumchim lechol oton dagim shekorim barbata. We eat this fish called the barbata. V'afilo yadino nimnishru kaskasim b'shash olam min hamayim. Even though we never see it having scales, we don't see the scales because once it's out of the water, there are no scales. The Gemara will tell us that scales on a fish can be either it had it when it was early on and then lost them, or it didn't have them and then gets them later. Either way, any time that there's scales on a fish, that's enough to make it kosher. So what he's saying is here, even though the barbata, when we see it, doesn't have scales on it, we don't have to go check whether it has scales in the water and then claim that they fall off when it's taken out of the water, because we just look at the roe, the fish eggs that are there, and we see it has the shape, and therefore we're done. Umiu mashma birushami dein smocha simanei ubrei dagim. So Tosfot says it's a definitive siman. Although then he backs away a little bit and says the Yerushalmi probably doesn't agree with this, but he says it seems from the Bavli that's way, and it's clear that Tosfot are practicing based on this psak from the Bavli. They're eating this barbata fish, even though they have no idea whether it has scales, and they're just assuming it must have had scales at some point, because otherwise the eggs wouldn't indicate this way, and they're eating the fish based on the eggs of the barbata. Now, Tosfot goes on towards the one before the widest lines of the Tosfot. Mashanu luchim in obdei kochavim beitzim. Afo pishenam omrim shal of ploni utorim heim. How do we buy eggs today? We're buying eggs in the marketplace from non-Jews, and they never tell us which kosher bird these eggs are coming from. I mean that we're missing what the Gemara demands over here in terms of allowing you to buy such eggs. Anu somchim aro beitzim shemitzuim beinenu. We are relying on the fact that the overwhelming majority of eggs that's found amongst us, those shall ofot tohorim heim, that they come from kosher birds. So that is a basic statement, and the reason that eggs commercially that are sold in different countries today, we do not need a heksher on the eggs themselves, is for exactly this reason. Again, to have commercially viable eggs to be sold, they need to come from kosher birds, and they need to really come from chickens. It's the only bird that lays eggs on such a frequent interval that you can actually sell the eggs commercially. It makes sense to add up selling those eggs commercially. And therefore, we can rely, Tosfot says, on the fact that the majority of eggs amongst us are kosher eggs. Given that, you can buy them, even if he never identifies for you the type of bird that laid this egg or where these eggs came from, because you can assume anybody who's trading in eggs is trading in kosher eggs, because that's the only really commercial eggs that are sold amongst us. So that's Tosafot's statement about their time. And again, it remains true till today that we buy eggs in cartons, even though technically they don't have any extra on them, partly because the government does indicate that they're going to be eggs that come from a particular source, But more importantly, it's because commercially, nobody sells eggs that are non-kosher. It's just not worth it. And if they do, they're going to identify them separately because they're worth more money than selling them as regular commercial eggs. Those folks going from one chiddush to the next. The next chiddush comes out of a similar statement of the Baal Tosfot and Avodah Zarah, which is, Ublish. Fikantiush. He doesn't explain what it is over here, but from the rest of the Tosafot, you can kind of intuit. These are types of flour breads that have egg cooked into them. They have egg either cooked on top of it or inside of it. There's bread and egg that is mixed together. So here it says you can't take scrambled eggs from them, eggs that are mixed up. So it's over there. You're not going to be able to identify the egg afterwards. The egg's going to be scrambled inside over there. How are you going to do that? Lodamio. That's not comparable. Over here, you have an undermining of your chazakah. Since he's selling them scrambled up inside of a utensil of some sort, some serving dish, that's almost a guarantee, Yisrael Machramlo, that a Jew sold them to them, Shoyu Shel Trefa. That's why he's selling them like that, is because that's how he got them, or that's why there's a problem over here. But dough that's cooked with eggs inside of it, we don't worry about it, because the Jew's not going to sell it to the Goy that way, because it's an egg that's a Trefa. He's not going to sell it, I'm going to put it in the dough now because it's a trefa, and then sell it to the guy. That's too much work for an egg that's a trefa. You just sell it straight out to him, mix it up, and then tell him, look, this is the egg for you, and then no Jew will buy it from him. But to go through all the trouble of baking it into bread and saying that it's an egg that's a trefa, that's no way. Therefore, we're back to the majority. The majority of eggs are not from trefa. The majority of eggs are kosher eggs. What about the fact that it maybe had a blood spot, which we're going to deal with in the second half of today's daf? Majority of eggs don't have blood spots in them. So Tosfot is banking on this road for a number of things. Majority of eggs are not trefot. Majority of eggs are kshirot. Majority of eggs don't have dam in them. All of those majorities make it that if they're baking this bread with eggs inside of it, totally fine to buy from them. Umasim b'chol yom, shana ochlim beitzim megulgalot, afa pisheinu yecholot livadek. And we eat scrambled eggs all the time, even though you can't check them for blood spots or for other issues. We eat scrambled eggs all the time based on the rove, assuming that majority of eggs don't have blood spots, not an issue. What about bishul akum? You have bread, which is pat akum, and then you have eggs, which are bishul akum over here, because eggs you generally do not eat raw, and therefore bishul akum makes them into something that is edible. You have bishul akum, then you'd have to question whether they are something that's served on shulchan melachim, but let's assume that is true as well, that they are served on shulchan melachim. And therefore, it's something that would be subject to bishul akum. So he says, fine, you don't have a problem with kashrut, you have a separate problem of bishul akum. This is Tosafot the Shitotam in Avodah Zarah, that the gzera or the takana pat akum was eliminated, and it's no longer applicable. So over here, you could have bought the bread, because pat akum wasn't an issue. But nevertheless, the problem is now, here they were baked or kneaded with eggs. It's a problem of being regular cooking of an akum. That wasn't part of the heter. And this also is a view of the Rabbeinu Tam, that the zera of shlakot was totally separate from pat akum and other bishul akum institutions later on. And it's a much earlier zera or takana. And that did not disappear. So therefore, you have a separate problem of bishul akum over here. Even though we've eliminated pat akum, you still have a problem of bishul akum. And if you combine those two here, you're going to not be able to buy this item. But then Tosafot at the end says, even though we say the halacha is like the one who says that beitzim are problematic because of bishul akum, this dough that is cooked with eggs. Again, whether that means that it's an egg challah or egg bread, but here more likely it means that the egg was cooked inside or baked inside the dough itself. You shouldn't make it a suir, because if you look at this situation here, you're looking at an egg and bread, and you're telling me which one's the ikar? Is it the flour or is it the egg? It's clearly the flour. How do I know that? Because the bracha here is hamotzi, it's not shakal. That's a good indication as to what the ikar is. And therefore, we can rely on the Yerushalmi that says that pat akum was eliminated. If pat akum is eliminated, this is still pot, because we make a motzi on it. And therefore, we don't worry about bishul akum, even though eggs by themselves might be a problem bishul akum. Eggs subsumed in the bread are not a problem bishul akum, because the ikar is the pot, is the bread itself. And therefore, you can buy this as if it is pat akum, and don't worry about the eggs that are inside of this bread, or the eggs that are on top of this bread. Again, kashrut-wise, we already discussed why. And now for bishul akum-wise, he's saying that the eggs are just subordinate to the bread itself, and therefore they're not a problem of bishul akum. And Tosafot is saying that they're buying these breads with egg inside of them without any hechsher, Because they don't think there's a problem with Parakum, and they don't think there's a problem with Bishalakum. He says, on the other hand, Ein Lahatir Isashel Pashtida. It's mentioned here, it's mentioned Shulchan Aruch Gabe Shabbat, but it really is like a fried dough or a phyllo dough that has oil on top of it. It's not like a standard dough, but it has a lot more fat and oil in it. Shafilu Obe Kuchavim, and it was baked by a non-Jew, that you can't eat. So even though the other item we're allowing you to eat by the Pashtida, we're not going to let you eat it, because the fat or the oil remains intact, meaning that it doesn't get mixed into the bread, it doesn't get combined in such a way that you would say ikar and tafel, and separately, the shamnunit, before it gets put on the bread or added to the bread, it was already cooked, and therefore it separately was already pishlakum before it's combined with the bread. The eggs are brought raw with the bread, either mixed together or baked inside of them, and therefore the pishlakum happens simultaneously with the parakum. But parakum is the ikar, and therefore that overrides and says there's no bishlakum. By the shamnonit, you have two problems. It's subject to bishlakum before you ever get to the point of putting it together with the dough. And number two is, even after it's baked or made, the pashtida has oil floating on top, which is still separate from the dough. And that oil itself would be subject to bishlakum, because that's not subsumed in the dough. It's not called ikar and tafel, because it's still separate entity. That the egg already is batel from the outset. It's never a separate entity that became a sur. It all was combined in one and becomes a single entity. And for that reason, we can buy these items from the non-Jews, but we can't buy pashtida from the non-Jews. Again, it's an amazing Tosafot at a lot of levels. First of all, about the fact that we can rely on eggs to determine that a fish is kosher. Number two, that we buy eggs even though we have no way of knowing which bird they came from. Again, we're relying on the rove in all these situations. And even more importantly, they're willing to have you buy things from a goy where he's cooking something, baking something that includes eggs in it, which are subject to bishlakum. Nevertheless, the parakum governs over here, and parakum was waived according to Baalei Tosafot. Doesn't exist anymore. And therefore, you can buy these items from a non-Jew, but you can't buy the pashtida from there because of the fact that the oil was asur beforehand. Plus, the fact that it's separately identifiable, it doesn't really combine together with the dough completely, that makes it that there's a problem with bishlakum over here. What's amazing is that they don't even talk about what fats are being used, or whether they're using kosher or non-kosher fats, which would seem to be the major issue with this type of thing, as well as the fact that they use their own equipment to make this. They're not kosher for any of this, and they're buying from the non-Jews, even though they have no hechsher on them. And even though it would seemingly be problematic given the halachot that we know, but Tosafot finds ways to be matur this. And again, it was a way to make it that they could purchase things in the market or in the commercial sense and still be able to live amongst their non-Jewish neighbors. All right, Gemara continues over here. Amar Mar, we're going back to this discussion about the simanim of the eggs, and that is that chelbon v'chelmon u'ravim zeh bazeh, if the yolk and the albumin, the white and the yellow, are all mixed together, v'yadua shi beitzat asheretz. Then you know for sure that it's a egg that came from a sheretz. Mar says, the mayhilchuto. Why does it matter if the egg came from a sheretz? Meaning that if the egg is problematic, it's problematic whether it came from a bird that's tamei or it came from a sheretz that's tamei. You can't eat the egg either way. Why does it make a difference whether you identify it as an egg of a sheretz versus identify it as an egg that comes from a bird? If it starts to form or take shape, and then it gets a hold in it, then it has a problem of tumak adasho. A sheretz, and this has to be one of the eight shvatzim that the Torah says are tmeim, those shvatzim are mitamei adam. If you touch that sheretz when it's dead, that sheretz makes you tamei. How much of that sheretz you need to touch is a kadasho. The size of a lentil is enough to make you tamei. So now, if you have an egg, while the egg is sealed, you're not going to become tamei because it's completely covered and it's locked inside. So then you can't become tamei. That's number one. Number two is, before there's a sheretz inside, you can't become tamei from the egg because it's not a sheretz. It's an egg and not a sheretz. So the only time that you become tamei is if you have two facilitating events. One of which is rikma, that internally the egg has started to incubate enough where it's taking shape and the form of a sheretz, because that makes it into a sheretz. But still, even in that situation, if the egg remains whole and sealed, it's not going to cause you a problem. Once there's a hole in there, even a hair's breadth of a hole, then that opens up the possibility that the tumah now you can have access to, technically. And since they have access to the tumah, the egg turns into a shomer now of that tumah and allows that tumah to radiate outwards. And if you touch it, you're going to become tameh if you come into contact with it as a din like a sheretz. So again, if it has a hole in it and it's already taken the form of a sheretz, that's where it has a nafkamina. Again, is that a foolproof situation? Doma the nachashi. Maybe it belongs to a snake. Meaning that we agree that many shvatzim or reptiles lay eggs. It's not just the birds that lay eggs. But also within the world of shvatzim, you have a distinction between each shvatzim, the Torah says you are tamei if you come into contact with them, versus the shvatzim where they're not tamei. For instance, a snake is not a sheretz. It doesn't have a din of tumata sheretz. So now, when you have an egg that has the chelmon and chelbon mixed together, it could be coming from one of the shmona shvatzim. It could be coming from a snake. How do you know that by definition it is an egg that is tamei? Now, when it has a hole in it and you're touching it, could be a snake's egg. Could be an egg from another reptile that is not one of the shmona shvatzim. So how could that be the halachic nafkamino over here? El Amar Rava, so Rava gives a different understanding here, which is shim rikma v'achla. If it took shape and then you eat it, loke alem mishim sheretz hashoretz ala aretz. Then you get malkot for a sheretz haaretz, because it's not sheretz haof, but rather sheretz haaretz. And that's what Rashi says over here. That has to do with the type of hatra'ah, warning that you have to give the individual. Rashi says over here, if he had not told us that this was a beitz of a sheretz, I would have thought the reason he's chayav over here is because he's eating from a non-kosher bird. And therefore the hatra'ah, the warning you have to give over here is sheretz haof. Piyatra baby shim sheretz haaretz, lo loki. He wouldn't get malkot, or vice versa now. Here you have to give him sheretz haaretz, otherwise you're not going to get malkot for it. Or, if by a sheretz haof, you say sheretz haaretz, it's not going to work. So that's a way to identify what is a problem of sheretz haaretz versus sheretz haof. Then the Gemara says, ihoki ma'iriya ditmeya. Then if that's the case, why do you need it to be a non-kosher egg? If you're talking about now eating it, and that's the issue, well, if eating it's the issue, why is it only solely with a non-kosher egg that you have a problem of a sheretz, a sheretz al aretz, or possibly sheretz oof, or getting a malkot for it? Afilu de tohora nami. Even by a kosher bird or a kosher egg, you should have the same problem. Titania, we have a breita. Kol sheretz hasheretz al aretz. Anything that crawls on the ground. There are both efrochim shalo niftechu enehem. That comes to include chicks that have yet to open up their eyes. The Gemara Beitza ascribes or attributes this to Rabbi Elazar ben Yaakov. So Tosfot says over here, the Gemara shouldn't say Divrei Rabbi Elazar ben Yaakov in it, because it's not explicit in the Braita, it's what the Gemara concludes. So some people added it into the Gemara here that this is the view of Rabbi Elazar ben Yaakov, but it is not the view of the Rabbanon. The Chachamim disagree with this view. But that's only true with regards to an Ephrach. That's what's true with a chick that has yet to open up its eyes. Meaning that certain chicks, when they are hatched out of the egg, for the first couple of days, they can't see and they don't have any plumage on them. It takes a little more time of incubating outside of the egg before they are developed enough to have eyesight and other things. So if you eat the chicks in that early stage, that is considered to be a sheretz, a sheretz al aretz. It's not fully developed yet. It's not developed enough yet where you should be eating it. Therefore, you're in violation of sheretz, a sheretz al aretz. Now, the Chachamim disagree with that. But there is an assumption that even though the Chachamim disagree with an Ephrach, that they would agree with regards to a situation in which the egg is already developed. Meaning that if the egg or the chick is developed inside the egg, then there's no way you can eat it, even according to the Chachamim. Whether that's the Rabbon or Doraita, there at least seems to be a problem there that you can't eat something that's developed inside of the egg. And that's true with a kosher and a non-kosher bird or animal. And therefore, why are you specifying that this is only true by non-kosher eggs or reptilian eggs, that this is an issue? My answer is, midrabanan, vikra asmach ba'alma. That's only a din derabbanan. Midoraita, you would be able to eat them. Derabbanan, there is a problem, and then Rashi explains over here. Midrabananu de ka'asar bitorim. By kosher birds, it's only a sur midrabanan. Avalt meim, sheretz gamuru. If it's a non-kosher egg, then it's a full-fledged sheretz. Veloke, le divrei akol. You're gonna get malkot, according to everyone. V'chilo rikma isureika malkodeka. When it's not fully developed, Rashi says there is an isur, but you're just not going to get malkot for it, the lav sheretzu. Says yet to attain the status of a full-fledged sheretz. So even though it remains a sur, you're just not going to get malkot. But nevertheless, what we're pointing out is that that statement of Rabbi Elazar ben Yaakov about an efrach, it's a sur, and if the chick is developed inside the egg, even according to the Chachamim, the sur is only true midah rabbanan, it's not true midah oraita, and therefore midah oraita, the only thing you're going to get malkot for is eating a non-kosher sheretz. If it already developed and you ate it, you get malkot for it. Because that's uniquely d'oraita, that if it's a developed sheretz, and then you eat such an egg, you're going to be chayab, a sheretz, a sheretz al aretz, which, again, is true by kosher eggs, by an efrach, but that's only true mi d'rabanan, it's not true mi d'oraita, the pasuk is just a nasmachta bi'alma. Now, Tosafot asks a question to which he brings a number of answers down, that have huge napkaminot alacha. Tosafot says over here, Vim tomar lachilo l'malkot l'amale rikma. Why does the egg have to be developed in order for you to get malkot over here when you eat it? Hai kaimalon, we have a principle, kolei yotzei min ha-tameh, tameh. Anything that is, quote-unquote, exuded by an animal that is tameh, is tameh. That means that a bird that is a trefa, that lays an egg, the egg is problematic because it developed inside of a trefa. And therefore, it has a status like a trefa. The egg is laid by a non-kosher bird. The egg is problematic. Not because you have a developed something inside the egg. It's simply because the egg itself emanated from something that is tameh. So Tosafot asks, I don't understand why you have to wait until it's rikma, until it starts to take form or shape of a sheretz in order to be chayav for eating it. It should be chayav from the moment the egg is laid. Whether they're Tillian egg, not kosher bird eggs, they should all be problematic from the moment that they're laid because they're coming from a non-kosher animal. If that's the case, they are non-kosher. They are tameim. And that should be an open, shut case. Where did this rikma come from over here? So Tosafot goes from one chiddush to the next as to how we view these situations. Tosafot does bring a position from the Baal Halachot Gedolot that says the only reason that you have to say that a beitzah of a tameh is tameh is to tell you that the beitzah of a tahorur is tahor. It's the diokat of that that's important. Not the fact that the Beitzah Tameh is Tameh. And that's why Hayotzei Min HaTameh is Tameh, and that would have been the din of the Beitzah Tameh. So you wouldn't need a pasuk for Beitzah Tameh, but the reason you have a pasuk by Beitzah Tameh is to teach you that by the Beitzah Tahor, you are Tahor. But that is somewhat problematic, because the Gemara later on is going to learn out that the Beitzah of a Tahor is okay because of Shiluach HaKain. And that's what leads Tosafot to offer two other alternatives as why this is true over here. Benir Lefaresh, the Beitzah of Tahor, Nafkalan, the Shari, the fact that a egg that emanates from a kosher bird is considered to be kasher, we learn out from Shiluach HaKein. But from there you see that you're allowed to eat the eggs that you take from the nest of a mother bird that you shoo away. And that's why we need, in the end of today's daf, Batayana to teach us the Beitzah of Tameh, that they are actually problematic. The Salkadat Chamina, this is what I would have thought. The fact that you can eat a kosher egg that emanates from a kosher bird is a huge chiddush. We would otherwise have considered or classified it as Eber Min HaChai. The general thing, anything that separates away from a live animal is classified as Eber Min HaChai. So an egg that separates away from a kosher bird would have otherwise been considered Eber Min HaChai. The fact that the Torah permits it is a chiddush. That Shiluach HaKein comes and tells you it's not classified as Eber Min HaChai. It's edible and you can eat it, no problem. But if I have that information, then I would be extrapolated that to anything. Which is that, just like by kosher birds, when they lay eggs, it's not considered Eber Min HaChai, so too by non-kosher birds, you would say the same thing, that it's not Eber Min HaChai. And the Torah was matir, because we have a special dispensation that tells us that by Shiluach HaKein, it's not classified as Eber Min HaChai. Once you extrapolate that to non-kosher birds as well, their eggs should have been kasherim. Therefore, I need a specific Isur to tell me that the non-kosher eggs are problematic. Not just because it emanates from something that's tameh. Is it tameh? That's not true. The reason they're asurim is because I have a specific pasuk telling me that they are asurim. Otherwise, they would not be asurim. So here you have a starting point which says that eggs should be all fine. That includes an egg of a kosher bird. That's an egg of a non-kosher bird and an egg of a sheretz. All of them should have been fine. Along comes the pasuk we're going to see at the end of today's daf. It says that eggs from non-kosher birds are not kosher. But that means that the eggs of the kosher birds are still okay, and the eggs of the sheretz are still technically okay. But he says, well, if you're not going to allow us to learn from an oaf tameh to a sheretz tameh, How are you going to learn that a trefa is asur? I mean, that we know eggs of a trefa are asur. So why is it that the eggs of a trefa are compared to an oaf tamei, but the eggs of a sheretz are not? Wouldn't it make more sense to say the eggs of a sheretz are also like an oaf tamei? The logic here is, birds from birds, we will learn. But Beit HaSheretz makes more sense to learn it from Tum'ah, which is that in general, we say that Achilat HaSheretz is connected to the Tum'at HaSheretz. And just like Tum'ah is Chehadasha, so to Achilat HaSheretz would be Asur B'Chehadasha. I mean that there is this correlation between them. And therefore, the Beit HaSheretz are going to be distinct or different than the Beitzim of an Oaf Tameh. And therefore, over here by the Beit HaSheretz, had it not been for the fact that Rikma, it started to develop, then it would not be Asur Midor, right, at least. And then he goes on to say, V'cheni yesh lefereish, gabi dvash shel dvorim, deshari. These are non-kosher animals. Why is that which emanates from them considered to be kasher? The din of a yotzei min tamei tamei is limited to milk and milk-like products, which is it's specifically stated about milk, and eggs aren't covered by that, because we said there, the Torah tells you that even though it looks like Eber Menachai, it's not, it's out of that category. And similarly with Dvash, that comes from a bee. That's going to be more like a Beitzah than it is like Chalav, and therefore it's going to have a din that a yotzei min tamei is Tahor, unless you have something that specifically tells you otherwise. And so by Dvash Karim, we don't have that. By the case of the sheretz, once it develops and it's Rikma, it becomes like a sheretz, and that's why it becomes a Sur. By Oaf Tamei, we have a specific pasuk that tells you that the eggs of an Oaf Tamei are problematic. So that's the first way Tosfot deals with this issue. Then Tosfot brings another possible answer. He says, V'od ha'inu yukolim namar, v'chol beitzim mutarot, ben tamei ben tahor. You can say that all beitzim are fine. Meaning that whether it comes from a tamei or a tahor, any beitzah is fine. And he says, the reason being, v'kulu beimi nami mishkik ledzera ka'atu, v'sharu mihai tamo. He says that the reason that it is tahor is because of a gemara in Bechorot, that says that the areas of the animal that develop from shichvat zera, from the semen of the male contributor, they are not considered to be part of the non-kosher animal. They're considered to be semen that went bad. And semen that goes bad isn't something that is tamei, or is not something that is considered or classified part of the animal. He brings examples of that, and then he goes on to suggest that the eggs are a similar phenomenon, which is that the eggs really come from the semen of the male contributor. They are mutarim to eat for that reason. Chutz mi beitzat tmeah shasara katuv. With the exception of where the pasuk tells you, like we're going to see later in today's daf, that it comes from a non-kosher bird, that it is considered to be non-kosher. So Tosfot here goes at a second attempt to say that the reason that the eggs are okay until they develop into sheretz is because until that point, it's just considered to be raden shechvat zera. And raden shechvat zera is not a sewer. And since it's not a sewer, the egg should be fine. It says, Umiyu, ain't mityashiv tamze. I don't know if this really works so well. Kabe beitzim, dekulu, mitchilatan, mi'urot, bikidin, makashuvin, kibasar. Says, that's not the way that eggs develop. He says, eggs start out in a development process where they are very small, wrapped up in the veins and sinews of the female, and then the egg starts to develop. That's before there's any shikvat zera that is added to the egg. It's before the fertilized egg develops. And we know that even if there's no shikvat zera there, the egg fully develops and you just have an unfertilized egg. So to say that the egg comes from the shikvat zera is a very difficult position to take. But the Baal Tosfot suggested as an alternative as to why possibly eggs before the development of the sheretz in them might be okay. Whereas the Ramban deals with the issue, and that's what we said in Rashi before, which is that even though it's not a surmi shuma sheretz, a sheretz aretz, it's still a surmi doraita. I mean, and that's why the Gemara is focused on Rikma, because Rikma elevates it to the point where it's considered sheretz, a sheretz aretz that would get malkot. Alright, Tarabanan. Gi'ulei beitzim mutarot. Rashi over here explains it as, beitzat meyash nitbashlaim torah. If you have a non-kosher egg that got cooked with kosher eggs, then it's not a problem. Mutarot, hatorim demaya ba'almu. An egg is like water. And they don't give any flavor to the other eggs that are there. And so therefore, when you have a mixture of kosher and non-kosher eggs, you don't even have to worry about notein tam. It's batel because non-kosher egg is just like water. And since it's like water, it doesn't give any tam and it has no bearing on the mixture and it's a kosher mixture. That's how Rashi explains it. So then Tosfot brings, well, what Rashi is saying over here is not logical. That's like coming out of the middle of nowhere. What are you talking about, mixtures and tarovet? That's not our topic over here. Our topic over here is eggs. And our topic is whether it's a kosher egg or non-kosher egg. Our topic is not about eggs getting mixed together. So why all of a sudden in the middle of a sukkah about eggs, we're coming out with the tarovet issues, which are subject to our din in Avodah Zarah, later on in Chulin, but they're not the subject of the topic of our Gemara over here. Benirlo Kamosha Perish Aruch. It's a case where they banged the Tarnagolet by its area where it lays the eggs, and they caused it to miscarry and drop the eggs out before they were finished. And it's not dealing with cooking with Rashi says here, a tarovet through a bishul, rather it's talking about these premature eggs that were forced out of the bird. So now, those eggs, you would have thought that they are problematic, mishum gi'ulei beitzim, because they didn't go through their full process of development, but rather they were miscarried and then let out. And therefore, you would have thought maybe they should be problematic. Along comes this Gemara to tell you, the lo choshev eiver min achai. It's a continuation of what Tosafot said before. Afo bishlo nigmaru legamre. Even though they're not fully developed, these eggs, it's not considered to be eiver min achai. That's true even in earlier stages of the egg, that it has a classification of being a kosher egg. Even though it's coming out before it was fully developed or fully finished, it's still not classified as eiver min achai, and it's mutar to eat these eggs. And that's the chiddush of the bright over here. And Tosafot then shows that the Yerushalmi seemingly supports Rashi's interpretation of the Braita, and the Tosefta seemingly supports the Oruch's contention about what the sugya is over here. So then it turns out that the Machloket Rashi and the Oruch is really a Machloket Yerushalmi Tosefta as how do I understand this Braita over here. Then, Beitzim Muzarot. If you have beitzim that are already, we call them mixed, developed, nefesh yafet tochlein. If you can handle those types of things, you can eat it. Meaning that it's just a recommendation, it's not a kashrut issue, just a recommendation that you better have a good stomach for these things, because most people can't eat them. What we're speaking about here is an egg that was incubated. But Rashi says over here, it's not a fertilized egg, and there will never be a chick inside of them, because it was never fertilized. So the chicken sat on this egg thinking it was a fertilized egg, but it's really not a fertilized egg. So what ends up happening to the egg inside is it's not going to develop into any chick. Nothing's going to happen along the way. All that's going to happen is the egg's just going to go bad inside of there. It's just going to get rotten or break down. It's not being refrigerated. It's not being kept in a good condition. And the bird's sitting on it. It's heating the egg through that whole period. So he says, nefesh yafet tochlein. They're kosher eggs because there's no developing chick inside. There's nothing non-kosher about them. They're just a little bit disgusting to eat. So if you can handle that, then you're permitted to eat them. Nimtza alea koret dam. If you find on it a blood spot, zoreket adam v'ochelet ashar. You're allowed to throw away that blood and eat the remainder of the egg. Amar Rabbi Yirmiya. Now Rabbi Yirmiya qualifies that. Oh, shenimtza ala kesher shela. That's only it's found on the kesher. But if it's found other places in the egg, seemingly, it would be problematic. And that is then, Tani Gustai Avud Rabbi Aptoriki, Lo Shanu Ela Shenimtza Ala Chelbon Shela. That's only true if it's found on the albumin, the white part of the egg. Avod Nimtza Ala Chelbon Shela, if it's found on the yolk, Afilu Beitza Asura, then the entire egg is problematic. My Taima, the Shada Tichla Bekula. Because then it's spread out into the egg. It's developed into the egg. The truth is that you can get blood spots in eggs for different reasons. You can get them because of the blood from the mother in the early stages of development. You can get it from the developing chick inside exuded some blood or some blood leaked out of it. Or it could be in the development process, there was some blood that got into the egg. What's being said over here is that, so if the blood is in a one location, and we'll discuss location-wise what that means, then all you have to do is take the blood out, then the remainder of the egg is fine. If the blood is already found, the way that Rashi is going to say it over here, in the yolk, that's already an indication that the chick has started to develop, and the blood you're finding in the yolk is a result of blood coming from the chick, and it's already moved from where it initially would have been, to that point means that it's spread throughout the egg. If it's spread throughout the egg is already problematic because it's no longer an egg anymore. It's starting to be a chick, and a chick that has some problem or limbs or blood that has already leaked into the egg, and that's why it's problematic. We'll read Rashi first and then see how Tosafot disagrees with Rashi significantly on this. He says, Huzera Shiltarnagola Hakashur Miroshakad Shilabetsa. Rashi identifies this as being the semen. This is a fertilized egg. And the semen sits up at the rounded side of the egg. And that's where the chick starts to develop from that side. Since it's still there, it's clear that it hasn't spread through the egg. Therefore, you can eat the remainder. Or what Rashi is essentially saying is that you have the fertilized egg. But the fertilized egg starts out with the contribution of the male being separate from the contribution of the female. The female contributed the egg. The male just contributed the shikhmat zera, the semen. But Rashi is now saying that the kesher is an identification of the semen of the egg. And that as long as that remains there, that's fine. Once it's on the yolk of the egg, then the entire egg is problematic. As we explained here, if it's found on the yellow, that's an indication that it has spread. So now, in terms of the egg itself, if you took a cross-section of an egg and you sliced an egg in half, what you'd be looking at is two parts of an egg. You'd have the white on the outside, which is the albumin, and the yolk on the inside, which is the yellow. In both the yolk and the white, there's something called the kesher. The kesher is a stringier part that attaches it to the egg itself. It's like a narrow white piece that extends out of the egg. The chalaza, which is a fiber strip that joins the egg to the shell, both at the top and the bottom. Although in truth, it has really nothing to do with the fertilization of the egg. So unlike what's being described over here, that there's a kesher on the round side, the kesher for the white of the egg exists both on the narrow side and on the wide side of the egg. Similarly, for the yolk itself, it also has a kesher in it. There's some part of it going into the center. There's a kesher in there as well, which is either the blastoderm or the cicatricula, which both are the point in the yolk where the development begins. What Rashi says over here is that the kesher is really the shechmat zera, and therefore, as long as it's on the kesher, you're okay. But once it's spread away from the kesher into the, whether it's the yolk or seemingly into the chelbon, even to the white itself, then it's going to be problematic, because that's an indication that the shechmat zera has already started to spread, and now you have a blood that's now been distributed amongst the whole egg, and it's no longer just located in that specific location by the kesher. The Rashi turns out to be a big chumrah here, which is unless you find it on that kesher of the white, then you're going to have a blood spot that is a problem. And for Rashi, the statement of Tana Dudustai is just a continuation of Rabbi Yirmiyah. That Rabbi Yirmiyah, that Nimsa Kesher Shela, is modified by the next statement, which is the difference between white and yellow. Which is, that's only true if it's found on the kesher of the white part of the egg. It's not true if it's found on the kesher of the yellow part of the egg. That means in the yellow part of the egg, it's always problematic. In the white part of the egg, if it's on the kesher, it's okay. If it's not on the kesher, it's problematic. That's the view of Rashi. So then Tosfo brings that view of Rashi, Perish Pakuntres, Umiya Kasha the Perusho. Says the problem with Rashi's explanation is a gemara that we're going to get to in Kretot, which seems to indicate otherwise, which is that when you speak about dam that you're chayav karet for, excluded from that dam that you're chayav karet for is dam that's found in an egg, and dam that is found in a locust. That is totally fine. Just like the blood of a locust and a blood of a fish is mutar, as long as they're together with that item, because then it's clear it's coming from them and not from another source. Similar by dam beitzim, it would be mutar legamre. So then, how can Rashi over here say basically dam is always problematic except for that one location? That's the problem with his explanation. Beyesh lomar, says maybe by the beitzim, it's a din derabana that they're machmir, because xero auto dam of, which is a problem mide oraita. Mide oraita enochanami, the dam in an egg is okay. Xero derabanan auto the dam of a bird, that's why we are gozera problematic. And even though in the end it's going to be a chick, and even though that's where the chick develops from, at this point it's not flesh, it's not an animal. The Tosfos deals with that reconciling between Rashi and that Gemara and Kretot to say that there's a din derabanan over here, and even though in the end this blood is going to develop into an efroach, nevertheless, when it's on the kesher, it's still in an early enough stage that it's not considered basar, it would be mutar midoraita, and you could have eaten the blood. Forget about the egg itself, you could have eaten the blood itself as well. But in the end, we make you take the blood out because it's too close to a chicken. The od yesh lomar. Now, Tosfos brings a different view here. The dam on the kesher is actually asur from the Torah. That since the chick in the end will develop from it, the dam itself is asur. You can't eat the dam. And then, how to show you a second great dot? It's what case when you find the dam not on the kesher, Because that's the initial stages of development of the Afroch. So Tosfot here deals with the situation, which is, depends where the blood spot is. So before he was saying that any blood spot in the earliest stages would have been mutar, and to gezeira, otu. Once it goes into the development stage, then the blood's problematic. In the second answer, he's saying that blood on the kesher is problematic, and it's problematic because it's going to develop into a chick. And therefore, it's dom, that's real dom, and you got to take it out. But if the dom is found somewhere else, not where the beginning of the chick development is, that dom is mutar the gamre, and that's what's spoken about in the Gemara in Kratot. And he says, this happens to us all the time. Right as the egg is laid, you crack it open, and there's dom. There's blood in there. That's not coming from the mating of the male and the female, because it's so early on, and it's not in the area where the development starts. So then, that dom is dom that is mutar. But then, of course, that goes against Rashi. The dom that was outside the kesher is always a sore. That's only true if the blood started in the kesher and then spread out. If there's no blood on the kesher, then it would be mutar legamre. So that's Tosfot's second shita. Again, the first shita says that blood even on the kesher is mutar to eat. And it's only osur mida rabbanan. The second view says that blood on the kesher is a sore. And blood that extends from the kesher would also be a sore as long as it started in the kesher. Because that's the initial stage of the development of the afroach, and that's a problem. But if you find blood anywhere else, and it's not found on the kesher, that's mutar. That's the second view of the Baal Tosfot. And then, he brings a third view. Maybe our Gemara follows the din in Kratot and says, all dam in an egg is mutar. That's when it's found on the kesher. Oz zoreket adam v'ochelet ashar. Avim ein adam al kesher l'makom acher, mutar afilo dam. You don't have to pull it out at all. You can just eat the blood itself. And therefore, only when you find the dam on the kesher would be problematic. Anywhere else you find the dam, as long as it's not spread from the kesher, would be muta legamre. You wouldn't even have to remove the dam. You can eat the dam along with the beitza. There's a huge kula that comes out from the Baal Tosafot against that view of Rashi, where Rashi says automatically anything that's outside the kesher makes the whole beitza surah. It's on the kesher, you can move the dam, and then eat the remainder of the egg. Tosfot suggests that if the dam's not in the kesher, you could eat the egg with the dam in it. In one case, he says you have to remove it. In one case, he says you could even eat it with the dam in it. That's because that's not dam, that's the development of an efroach. Only if it starts in the kesher and spreads is there a problem. And even in the kesher itself, you only have to take out the dam, and you can eat the rest, because there you haven't even started development. Only if it leaks out of the kesher, does that mean that there was a development that spread, and therefore the whole egg becomes a sore. So again, it's a much narrower scope of where a blood spot is problematic. So the way Rashi is learning it is that Tane Dustai's position is just really a repeat of Rabbi Yirmiyah's position, which is that it's only when it's found on the kesher, and that is only true when it's found on the kesher of the chelbon, but that's when you can take it off and then keep the rest of the egg. If it's not on the kesher, then you have to get rid of the egg. That's the view of Rashi, and some of the Rishonim that are explaining Rashi. The Rif, on the other hand, has a different view, which is that Rabbi Dustai is arguing on Rabbi Yirmiyah. And he believes that there's no distinction between kesher and not kesher, but the distinction is between whether the blood's found in the chelbon or the chelmon. And that is, if the dom's found on the white part of the egg, then the rest of the egg is mutar, you just have to take it out. But if the blood spot is found in the yellow part of the egg, then it's a surah kula, because that's already tzichila to mikum. Alright. Amale, Rav Gavia, Mibei Katil, the Ravashi, Ipcha, Tani, Tana, Kameh, Abaye. A person was bringing a braita before Abaye, and he said just the opposite. Rabayehu, the Taratzda, Niale, Hachi. And Abaye actually fixed the braita up to get it to work the right way around. So, as Rashi here says, that's only true if it's found on the chelmon. But if it's found on the chelbon shela, it would be a surah, which is the opposite of what we have. We said if it's found on the chelbon, it's okay. If it's found on the chelmon, it's not okay. And he had brought a braita that said the opposite. If it's found on the chelmon, it's okay. If it's found on the chelbon, it's a surah. And Abaye flipped it in order for it to work out and make sense. And the question of why Rav Gavia is bringing this, either he's saying that the source of this was originally incorrect and we got it fixed through Abaye, and he's telling you Abaye is the source for this discussion, or he's saying to you, maybe this is a dat yachid, because Abaye flipped a braita, and who says we can rely on this because it comes from Abaye? I'll send out Mikorot on the blood spots, but the Mefarshim and then the Poskim deal with the fact that today, all the eggs that we have are really unfertilized eggs, or at least a large majority of the eggs are unfertilized eggs, and given that, then there should be no issue in terms of the blood spots that are found in the eggs being problematic no matter where they're found, because they're never the beginning of the development of a nefrach, and therefore it should always be okay just to pull the blood spot out and eat the egg. So Rav Moshe Feinstein in a tshuva indicates that that probably meikar din is the halacha, and even though when he actually wrote his tshuva, there was still a decent amount of eggs that were still somewhat fertilized and mixed in with the unfertilized eggs, even though the overwhelming majority were unfertilized. But today, it's almost a guarantee that the eggs are unfertilized, unless, this is an important exception, they are organic or free-range eggs, which might then end up being fertilized eggs and could be a more significant problem and need to be checked. And so he says, technically, even though Meikar HaDin, you would not need to check these eggs, nevertheless, the minhag is to check the eggs. And beyond that, he says, when we find a blood spot in the egg, because it's more trouble to take the blood spot out, and it's not worth so much money, we just throw the whole egg out, and we don't even bother with taking out the blood spot. Rav Avadi Yosef, writing about a similar topic over there, says about Rav Moshe's tshuva, that that's true for the rich Americans, who can afford to throw it at an egg. But here in Eretz Yisrael, where the eggs are more expensive, and we aren't so wealthy, he says that the minhag is to pull out the blood spot, and to use the egg. And therefore, it's totally fine to do such, take out the blood spots and use the eggs, because again, there's no real necessity to worry about the egg being problematic, because an nefrach can't develop in it, and we just want to take out the blood spots. Therefore, there are also other implications, which are that if by some chance, b'diavad, the eggs weren't checked, then we don't need to worry about the kashrut of the item, because again, a la robe, they don't have blood spots, and even if they have blood spots, according to the Baal Tosafot, they'd be mutarim. And even those blood spots are definitely not an efroch, and it's going to be batel, so it's not an issue. Kashrut. Now, the chatfila, we would prefer that you check the eggs, but you don't necessarily have to check the eggs, but the minagam is to check the eggs and to make sure that the eggs that are used don't have these blood spots in them. And again, as I mentioned before, if there's any possibility that they come from fertilized eggs, like some of these newer organic and free-range type eggs, then you definitely have to check them, because then it becomes a significant possibility that a blood spot would be a problem. And depending on the shito, because of the difficulty, we probably would just throw the egg out if we found a blood spot in that case. Amar Chizkiya, minayin lebeitzat tmeya shi asura min haTorah. How do you know that a non-kosher egg is asura min haTorah? This is what we referenced to in the Baal Tosafot vote before. It's not obvious that an egg that comes from a non-kosher bird is considered to be non-kosher. They're looking for a source min haTorah. Shenemar, because the pasuk says, ve'et bat hayana, which is a reference to the ostrich. V'chi bat yesh la yana, does the yana have a daughter? It could just be an expression, but the way that the Ramban learns it is, why does it matter if you have a daughter and a mother? Whatever the mother is, the daughter is, and whatever the daughter is, the mother. So if bat yana was really a bat of a yana, just say that the yana is problematic. Why are you telling me that there's a bat yana that is problematic? Ella ezuzo, what's that? Beitzat meya. Bat yana doesn't mean literally the daughter of an ostrich, but rather it means the egg that is laid by the ostrich. The other way to learn it is that bat yana, they don't have children. So why are you talking about a bat yana? Ella, it must be speaking about a beitza. That's the other way to learn it. Bedelma hainushmayo. How do you know that that's not the name of the animal? Just like we have certain species that are known, like, truthfully, we say B'nai Yonah. Over there, the Gemara also darshans it. I mean, it has to be the young ones. But you could have a species where the species is known as Bat Yana, and not necessarily as Yana. And that's why it's called a Bat Yana, not because it means the daughter or the offspring or something that emanates from it, but simply that's the name of it. Lo sal kedatcha. You wouldn't have thought that, tichtib, because it says in Eicha, Batami la'achsar. My nation became uncaring, were cruel, ki ye'enim bamidbar, like the ye'enim in the desert. And the truth is, the way that it's spelled in the Ktiv, in Eicha, is ki enim. It's actually two words over there. But anyway, the words combining them together to read as ki ye'enim bamidbar. So here you see that the ya'ana is referred to as ki ye'enim. There's no bat there. And it's speaking about the akhzariyut of the ye'enim. which leave their young to fend for themselves when they are very young. And therefore, Bnei Yisrael are compared to Vayanim Bamidbar, which is that the circumstances or the situations were so dire that they forgot their kids, they didn't have mercy on their kids, because they were in such a desperate state of the siege of Yerushalayim. Below, is that really true? Aktiv, doesn't it say in Micha, Ese mispeid ketanin ve'evel kivnot yana? I will make a eulogy like the jackals, ve'evel kivnot yana, and a mourning like the daughters of the yana. The bnot yana are not the ones that are in mourning. It's the yana that is in mourning over its daughters. So if you say it as kivnot yana, that seems to indicate that the name of the bird is bnot yana, not that yana is the name of the bird, it's the daughters of the yana. So the very answer is ki yana zo shemitabelet al banah. Bnot yana is what you call an assumed subject, which is that it's the evil of the yana al bnot yana, basically. It's the evil of the yana over her children, and then there's a unspoken subject here. Vaktiv, don't we have the pasuk in Yeshayahu which says v'shachnu sham bnot yana? And then the bnot yana will dwell over there. So again, it's not the daughters of the yana that are dwelling over there. It is that the yana is dwelling over there. That means that it's a proper noun, which is a phrase of bnot yana. That's the name of the bird. My answer is again, yana zo shishochenet im bana. It's similar to the yana that makes a nest there. It lives there together with its children, with its offspring. So again, there you would say that there's an unspoken subject. Shachnu sham, they will live there, the yana, im bnot yana, along with its children, it will live there, they will dwell there. Vaktiv, what about the fact that it says, techabdeini chayata sadeh, tanim ubnot yana? It says that they will give honor to me. They will sing praises to me. It's a reference to a Kodesh Baruch Hu in Yeshayahu, that they will sing praises to you, the chayata sadeh, the animals of the field, the tanim, the jackals of bnot yana. So now again here, if you think that bnot yana is the bird itself, then you can understand how they sing shira to a Kodesh Baruch Hu. On the other hand, as b'isal kadatcho beitzah, ba'itzah bad meimar shirai, if you think it's an egg, eggs don't sing praises to Hashem. Ela k'tiv hayana uk'tiv batayana. Sometimes the Torah uses the word yana, sometimes it uses batayana. B'shani ochal, the posok, stafra l'shtei tevot. And over here, it's unusual because it was split into two words. Oh, mit posok la safra b'tarte tevot, shma amina t'rei shemot ninu. Since it's split into two words, it's clearly speaking about two different items. So now, what's being said over here is that bat yana in the Torah is written one word bat, and then yana. Had it been that it was a single entity, it should have combined the words and written bat yana in one shot. And therefore it would have been this singular entity called the bat yana. But by separating the words out, it's indicating that yana and bat are separate entities. And yana is yana, and bat is the eggs of the yana. Now that still doesn't help you out with regards to that pasuk in Yeshayahu, which says uvnot yana. Because over there it also writes them as two separate words. And then how are you going to explain that it's speaking about the eggs of the yana in Yeshayahu, because they don't sing shira? So what you have to answer is over there it was forced to separate it because of the plurality. Because over there it wanted to say it in plural, it says uvnot yana, it had to pull the word out. But in the case of bat yana, then you would combine the words together. What it's saying in essence is that sometimes the Torah uses bat yana, sometimes yana, and knowing when it's bat yana means a separate entity is when the words are separated. But if the words aren't separated, then it's not a separate entity, and the bnot yana and Yeshayahu are separated because of the plurality issue, not because they're separated out to be two different terms. Again, even though in general, throughout the Torah, anytime it says bnot yana or bat yana, it keeps them as separate words. But you have to argue that the plurality is different than the singular, and that's what's unique over here, is that it uses the bat yana in the singular form and keeps the word separate, and that's already indicative of the fact that you're dealing with two things over here. Gemara says, Elamiato, what are you going to do with the pasuk in Reshit that says, et kedar laomer? Kedar laomer, in all the Sifrei Torah that we have today, is written as a singular word. There were Sifrei Torah in the time of the Rishonim that did have the word as a separate entity, and even though we find indications in the Gemara that it was a word that was separated. Nevertheless, our Mesorah is to keep the word together. And when you have a stira between Mesorah and what the Gemara says, we follow the Mesorah. And there are a number of these in Shas where the Gemara seems to indicate there's something true of a Sefer Torah that we don't have. So over here is one of them, which is Kedar Laomer. It's a separate word. The Pasuk Lu Safra Bitzrei. So over there, it's also split into two words. Hachanami Detarte Shmeininu. You're going to tell me those are two different people. Kedar and Laomer are two different people and not one person. Imre Hatam B'Shtei Tevot Pasuk Lu B'Shtei Shitim Lo Pasuk Lu. Over there, we allow you to separate the word between Kedar and Laomer, but doesn't mean we allow you to split it between two lines. It is a proper name. Kedar Laomer is one word in terms of a name. So even though we're allowed to split the name, you're not allowed to put it on two different rows. So you can't have Kedar on one row and then Laomer on the next row. That's not true. Here by Batayana, not only can you write it on a single line, Bat Hayana, and have them be separate, you can even write Bat, the last word of one line, and begin the next word, next line is Hayana. And that shows you or indicates to you that it's much more separate than that of Kedar Laomer, which means that both of them are separate words, but there's limitations on that separation by Kedar Laomer that makes it it's considered or classified as a single word, versus by Batayana, where they can be separated completely. It can be drop a line and continue on the next line, and that's already indicative of the fact that it's a completely separate entity. And if that's the case, that differentiates us from Kedar Laomer. Even ago, again, our Torahs don't have this by Kedar Laomer. But this also has nafkamino to halacha for other items that require ktiva. So for instance, get, which is an area where you do require ktiva, then these principles would be applicable as well. And the Rashba brings this as both a kula and a chumra. The kula is that if you write the name of a person and you leave spacing in the middle of the name, that would be fine. Because over here we see Kedar Laomer, even though it's one name, has a space in it, it's fine. If you have a name and you drop half the name down to the next line, that would be problematic. So you have a kula that on a single line you can break spacing in the name. And if you chumra is if you drop a name down, split it, half on one line, half on the next line, then it'd be problematic in terms of the ktiva. Okay, we're going to stop here by the two dots on the top of Samachay Amad Aleph.